Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
The Science of Sports Podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch. Coming up.
My shot at professional sport was denied because of this disruption. The overconsumption of fluid is a big contributor to nausea. When you're winning, you don't stop. When you're beaten, you slow down. Is performance limited by the mind or the matter? So welcome back to our second episode of our Q&A to our Patreon supporters, and a big thank you to our Patreon supporters. A couple of weeks ago, we did our first episode where we answered questions from our Patreon supporters and came up with some very good answers to some excellent questions. And we're going to be doing our second half today. And while we're talking about our Patreons, I want to ask Ross to a bit of a shout out to our latest patron supporters on Patreon.
Yeah, we love our patrons. So thanks very much to all of you, those who pledged last year when we set this up, and those of you who have come on board in the last while. I must be honest, I don't remember when last we sat here and recorded, so I can't remember if I might have already thanked these people for joining. But we have three levels, as you know. There's Olympic athletes, Olympic champions, and then the top for Olympic legends. And we've got a handful of each to just welcome to the community this week. We have Mangoes and Limes, an Olympic athlete, S.M. O'Sullivan, Tim Couture, Aidan Alone, and Ken Hoare. Thank you for your patronage. They're coming at Olympic athlete level. We've got some Olympic champions. They are Brendan Krull, Jack Bradbury, Ricka Albert's daughter, Andy Hilton, Asher Aziz Geardotter, Aaron Fong, and Duncan McRobert. And then finally, our Olympic legends. This is our sort of top tier of membership. They are Finn Harrod, who I often have a few exchanges of views and opinions with on Twitter. So good to see you over here as well. Mark Carroll, thank you very much. Joel Natale, Jan Malikar, and Hamish McGlashan have all joined at the Olympic legend level. So again, thanks so much, guys. We love doing this. We do it anyway, and we will continue to try our best to do it. But these monthly donations certainly make it worthwhile, and we're going to continue to try and do little things for those patrons once in a while to make it worth yours also.
And a big thank you. A very special message we got from a gentleman by the name of Adrian Friedman, who is an advocate in Johannesburg, who sent us a very sweet message. And if you don't mind, it's quite nice to pat ourselves on the back once in a while. But Adrian, thank you very much for your very splendid message. You said that Ross is very good at describing complicated things, not in an oversimplistic way. And I think it's quite a good little analogy there, where he talks about in his profession as an advocate, trying to explain complicated things is one of the challenges that he has to deal with. But he says that, Ross, you in particular, explain things simply, but not simpler than they are, which is important. And he even says, I ask good questions, which I'm very happy with this too. So thank you very much, Adrian, for that. And Adrian Apte's patronage as well in the process. So a big thank you to Adrian for
that. That was from Olympic legend to whatever lies above that. That's Mount Olympus material there for him. So thanks very much. The thing that
I'll tell you who I'm going to go to if I need any legal help in Johannesburg. It's going to be Adrian Friedman. I will look him up. Hopefully we never need him.
But the thing that makes me the happiest is that obviously he's a highly qualified, intelligent person who also loves sport. And when you hear from people like that, impressive individuals, then it's very meaningful, I think. Great. It's quite humbling. And thank you very much to him and also everyone else. And also to Ricka Albertson, whose name I missed. I confused two rows in this spreadsheet earlier, so I do apologize. But Ricka, thank you very much. Olympic champion, also part of the family. So.
Yeah, so people from all over the world, and you can just see by the names that Ross had to try and get through there that our audience is spread not only here in South Africa, but the majority of audience really based overseas. And just to give you an idea of our numbers, about 40% of audience is in the UK, and and Europe, and it spreads right throughout the US down to Australia, and we've got some listeners in the middle of Africa and all sorts of places all over the world. So a big thank you to all of those that are listening throughout the world. Thank you. Right, so let's get on to our first of our questions. As I said, this is the second in the series of questions from our Patreon supporters. And the first question comes from Martin Hawkins. He says, it's not a sports science question I've always wanted to ask, but certainly one that's topical. With the global stoppage of non-elite sport for almost a year now, how does this affect the young athlete development pathway? There will be a number of youngsters who have the potential to develop into elite sport, who are at a critical point in their development, who may miss stages of the skill or strength development. So what are the key stages and the ages that they are most pronounced? And is there any way for children to catch up, or will we lose an entire age group to elite sport because of this COVID pandemic? I want to throw it straight at you, Ross.
Yeah, it's an interesting question because I think, not that we're out of this pandemic yet, but I think maybe it's a year on now, and maybe light is appearing at the end of the tunnel thanks to vaccines and just the number of people who are now no longer susceptible because of infection and vaccination. So as the dust settles, one of the things that will be interesting to see is the aftermath of what's happened, particularly to young people. We know, anyone listening to this with kids has known, you've been homeschooling them. They've been denied usual opportunities to play sport, to even be active, to even socialize. So there's probably a lot more than this, a lot more to this than even sporting development pathways. I saw a piece the other day where a survey had revealed that roughly a third of children had got not even half the recommended amount of exercise over the last 12 months. Because so that's one of the unintended consequences of lockdown. And so as this whole thing unravels, we will learn a lot more about that. But what Martin is asking is really interesting, because what we've done in society as adults is we've created what are basically funnels to take young athletes, sports people, from first exposure, say at the age of 9, 10, all the way through to when they potentially win an Olympic medal or get a professional sports contract. And there are these formalized pathways, got different names. He's alluded to long-term athlete development pathways, where we set milestones in place. We have age groupings. We make selections. Dependent upon those selections, we allocate resources. We choose A and a B team. The A team gets good coaches and better equipment than the B team. So there are all these filters and places where we could lose talent. There are places where we might pick the wrong talent. And so it's quite interesting to speculate, in the absence of any sport at all, how have those selections and how have those development processes looked? So it's a pretty interesting question. Now, the short answer is that most situations are going to be agile and flexible enough that someone who misses out at the age of 14 can catch up by the age of 15. We're not so fixed in time and space that we have one shot at it. Where I think that there may be issues is when a system is designed to be too rigid and inflexible, that young athlete is so reliant upon being in the shop window that when the shop windows are shuttered, so to speak, they lose their moment to express their abilities. And if the system hasn't given them another opportunity downstream or after that, then that opportunity might be gone forever. Makes sense? Yeah. It's like I'm waiting for a bus and the buses are cancelled, but there's no subsequent bus coming after the one that I was waiting on, and now I'm gone.
Yeah.
So resilient sporting systems are going to be the ones that still facilitate the inclusion of an athlete and the development of an athlete, even despite the COVID denial of those. There will be some.
Yeah.
For the most part, I suspect that athletes will simply catch up what they've lost.
So, I mean, the example that I think of that comes to mind first was, you talk about the drafts that happen in American sports in particular. Like, you know, you have a draft from college, you know, from high school to college and then college to professional sport. I mean, do we know how many people go into the various levels of draft per year? In other words, if there are 100 that go into the missed draft, do they then go become 200 the next year? I mean, are those sports more likely to be affected, or those particular age groups that might have been affected by a lack of a draft, formal draft this year?
Yeah, every every selection is a turnstile or a sliding door moment, if you want to call it that, mm-hmm. where the young athlete is either going to be selected or not. And when, as I say, when we have as a system created it to be a zero-sum game, then that moment is gone. You don't get the you know, at the age of 16, if your selection is going to be to the under 18 team, you don't get that selection at 17. It has to happen at 16. And so that's where the adaptable sports system and the best coaches will continue now to be a little bit wise and a little bit smart and savvy and say, okay, we didn't see this guy then, but we're going to keep an eye on him. So they will be able to absorb 2 years into one in an operational way, on the organically almost.
Yeah.
The problem is, and I mean, we saw this play out, in the US sports system, they were so desperate to get college sport going. They played through COVID for the most part. There were some pretty high-profile cancellations of matches. Some teams, a number of players opted out. And the reason they have to be so set on continuing is because that's the shot. You know, it's your last year at university. You could defer and delay your entry into the draft, and a number of those players will, so they get hopefully 2021 is their final college season. So it certainly is disruptive. But part of it is that the best young athlete will always be noticed. It's just that there are going to be some who really needed a stage to be noticed on, and that stage was denied to them. So in terms of selection, there will be some who will say, you know, I lost my chance because of COVID. And 10 years, 20 years, 30 years from now, there'll be people who say, my shot at professional sport was denied because of this disruption. Now, that is an inherent characteristic of all sports systems is inefficiency, because we can't select every young child to move from one level to the next, to the next, to the next. At some point, you have to, for the purposes of budgeting and resource allocation, you have to trim them. So you've got to go from 300 into 100 into 20, for instance.
Yeah.
And whenever you have those selections, you will invariably select the wrong people. And because it's a zero-sum game, selecting the wrong person means failing to select the right person. And so that will, of course, happen. So quantifying that will be difficult. It's bound to happen. But you'd like to think that there will be enough nuance and intelligence, wisdom almost, in the system that they'll avoid that. The other part of Martin's question that's interesting is whether there are windows of trainability that have been lost.
Mm.
Now, this is a concept that is inherent to long-term athlete development models. What these folk have done is they've come up with models and they've said, right, from the age of, say, 5 or 6, when I'm first learning movement competency, and you've got a daughter who is now in that age bracket almost.
Four. Yeah.
That you can see that she's learning movement. She's learning running, jumping, catching, throwing, etc. Now, as you progress and as you get older, the complexity of the skills change. You start playing sport with structured rules. So you start learning to play, and then you start training to train, and then you train to win, and then eventually you're playing to win. And so there's this natural progression of importance, intensity, complexity that is managed. And what they've modeled around that is that there are certain phases where you have what they believe to be these windows of trainability. So for instance, for strength, they say that the optimal window of trainability is immediately after they've started to grow at their fastest rate. It's called peak height velocity. Whereas in boys, it's a little bit after that. So it's 12 to 18 months after what's called peak height velocity. For speed, they talk about it being two windows, a few years before, one after. For flexibility, they talk about it being at very young ages. Now, there is no evidence that this is the case. So these models have been developed, I think, in what is a little bit of a circular argument where they've tried to retroactively fit how people should train on their biology as opposed to the other way around. So I'm reading here from a paper. This is as far back as 2011 by Paul Ford and a group of researchers, in which they critique long-term athlete development. And they say here, it appears there are a number of problems with this model that are not necessarily transparent to coaches. Principally, the model is one-dimensional and there's a lack of empirical evidence upon which it is based. And so, in effect, they're saying, yeah, you've got your models, but no one's ever shown that to be the case. I mean, you could take, we did a podcast on aging, 65-year-old, 75-year-old men can become significantly stronger if you train them for strength.
Yeah.
So the idea that there's a narrow window and you have to hit that specific attribute, strength, flexibility, speed, between the age of 14, 15 is simply not borne out by any evidence. And so I don't think that that's too big a concern either.
Yeah.
The biggest issue here is whether the system we've put in place is so inflexible and lacking in agility that we've given these kids one shot or nothing. And that's the problem that needs to be addressed.
Well, I suppose it is a good way for sport to maybe gauge its ability to be flexible within those talent ID processes through early childhood and into those early professional ranks. So I think time will tell, I guess, in the end, because we won't know the results of whether this will have an impact in sport maybe for another 5 or 6 years even, if it has any effects at all. Mm. It might just be a little blip on the professional horizon, but no more than that.
And even there, I was thinking in response to Martin's question, how would we even know in 5 or 6 years? Because one of the great things about this is when you don't pick a young athlete who could have been the next Steph Curry, or pick an athlete in this case, the next Usain Bolt, the next Roger Federer or Rafael Nadal, you don't, that's a known unknown.
Yeah.
You wouldn't know. If you knew he was the next one, you would have picked him. And if you didn't pick him and he could have been, you'd never know it. So how will we one day know that in 5 or 6 years? Maybe someday some statistician will work out that the average year of birth of professional sports people goes up sequentially, skipped a year in 2020, and then continue. Because...
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Theoretically, a kid who's 16, 17 now and has a disadvantage in 8 years' time, maybe that year of birth is going to be underrepresented in professional sport, and then we'd know something. But certainly worth keeping
somebody will probably do that study, I would imagine.
So there'll be a gap in the timeline.
Yeah.
You know, like for like...
There might be a gap.
People born in, what are we now, 20, people born in 2004. Are significantly less likely to get a professional contract than people born in 3 and 5. Maybe that's how it plays out.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's going to be because of training. It's going to be because of an artificially imposed selection system on sport that's going to cause that issue.
Well, we'll report back on that in episode 353 in 2026, if it all happens that way. So thanks very much for a very good question, and one worth certainly debating around the campfire on the dinner table some nights. Right, the second question is a little less philosophical, but a little bit more interesting in terms of how we all operate as human beings. It comes from Liz Elliott, who says, I run marathons and half marathons and normally finish them well. Most are early morning races, however, and on the few occasions I have run them in the evening, I have not been great afterwards. I'm dehydrated, low sugar levels, etc. Despite having followed a similar diet before and during the race, is there a reason for this? And I guess what she's asking, and there's two parts, because you went and engaged with her and asked her more detail about the exact processes she went through. But essentially, she's doing exactly what she does in the morning, in the evening, but the result after the race is not the same.
Right. So great question, Liz. And I went back to it because it's complex, I think. There's so many things that could be going on here. And I wanted to clarify it. So before we get into that complexity, let me offer you this as a conclusion is, our instinct is to say, just keep everything the same, whether it's a morning or an evening. Do the same things before and you'll get the same result. That's not necessarily true. And so if you go back and you listen to our previous podcast, which was an interview with Dr. Dale Ray, who's a sleep scientist, she explained very eloquently, fascinatingly, that every single cell in our body knows the time. And we are so responsive to what are these circadian rhythms driven by melatonin and our body's clock and our genes and so on. And one of the things she said to me off air is that even our gut bacteria are different in the morning compared to the afternoon, compared to the evening.
Wow.
So we are not necessarily the same people physiologically speaking, when we run a race in the morning as when we run the race in the evening. So in actual fact, doing the same thing might be the problem because you're not responsive enough to your own internal changes. So that's kind of like the short answer here. Now, that doesn't help Liz, so now we have to try and explain a little bit about what causes nausea.
It's also why I don't eat Rice Krispies at 7 o'clock at night.
Yeah, even your... And people know it's this, like your taste. You know,
yeah, that's true.
A Coke before breakfast feels weird.
Yeah.
A Coke in the afternoon feels normal.
Yeah.
So everything's different. And so the expectation that the same input causes the same output assumes that what it goes through is the same. And that's the key, is that our body's cycles mean that it might not necessarily be the case. So it's a fascinating question for that reason alone. That said, when we start to discuss nausea during exercise, this is a almost universal problem. I reckon 1 in 1,000 people has never been nauseous in exercise, if that.
Mm.
I mean, if I said to listeners right now, raise your hand if you've ever felt nauseous during or after exercise, I'm seeing 100% hands go up.
Yeah.
So there's data on this prevalence of nausea, and in any given race, between 10 and 20% will get nauseous. So that's 1 in 5 runners who start a marathon or a half marathon will report nausea. So we're gonna get some clues from the prevalence data here. So when they ask runners about their easy training days, it's only 2%. So it goes from 1 in 5 in a race to 1 in 50 in a training day. It goes up to 1 in 8 during a hard training session, increases further in a marathon. During ultra endurance, it's 20 to 30%. And when we get to the 100 mile distance, there are studies that have put it at about 60%. So that's 2 out of 3. So deduction number one is, what's driving nausea during endurance exercise?
Sugars.
Well,
maybe.
Maybe, but like, so if we take the data then, we said, right, it's more prevalent during high intensity, and it's more prevalent the longer you go.
Mm.
So duration and intensity matter. So that's your first sort of clue. So you say sugars because?
Well, people in particular in endurance events tend to drink a lot of goos and gels and often get nauseous because of that.
Mm. So the nutrition element is key. And obviously, when I'm running for 30 minutes, that's not a consideration. When I'm running for 30 kilometers, it's a consideration. And when I'm running for 120 kilometers, now it's a big deal. So yes, so let's try and understand that. Now, nausea is controlled by a region in our brains called the nausea center. There's actually a region of this in your body. I don't know if you knew that.
Nope.
It's situated in your medulla oblongata.
I've heard of that.
You have? Waterboy. Yep. There's a meme. There's a meme from the movie The Waterboy where the medulla oblongata is what makes alligators aggressive, and it also contains a center in your in that region that regulates nausea. Now, nausea is essential for survival, because if our bodies encounter toxins that could kill them, the best mechanism is to eject that thing as quickly as possible. So we get nauseous because of chemicals. We also get nausea because of a number of other things. So there's a vomiting center that receives inputs from various pathways. They include the gastrointestinal tract. They include something called the chemoreceptor trigger zone. So this is another area of our brain that detects chemicals, chemoreceptor, chemical receptor. It includes areas of the brain and thalamus, and then it includes the vestibular section. So that's balance. That's why you get nausea.
That's the bit, the bones in your ear.
That's inside your ear, yeah. Vestibular apparatus. So when you're on a boat and you start getting seasick from the movement, that's what's happening there. So that nausea, that vomiting center rather, is receiving multiple different inputs. So when we start thinking about exercise, we have to think, well, which of those might be triggered by exercise? Now,
sure. There's a lot.
And this is why it's such a complex thing.
Yeah.
And I know, in fact, I'm not going to go into this more, but I'll mention it here, is that my dad used to be a big time ultra distance runner, and a lot of his mates that he ran with used to get nauseous, and they discovered that taking seasickness tablets could help prevent that. And so they would run ultra marathons and pop a seasickness tablet at halfway and finish the race feeling less nauseous than
never
before.
Never heard of that.
Oh. Because you're shutting off one of the possible inputs.
Right.
So you're blocking off what would normally cause the vomiting center to fire up. So anyway, so if that vomiting center receives enough of those inputs and it's sufficiently large, then what happens is we've got these efferent motor pathways, that means outgoing, that cause retching and ultimately vomiting. So we expel the source of the nausea. So a couple of the key things. The gastrointestinal tract is a major player here. So that means our guts and our intestine, our circulation around there. And one of the things that is happening when we exercise is that we are sending blood where it is necessary, which is the muscle and the skin. But we don't have an infinite supply of blood, so therefore we are taking from elsewhere. And one of the places we take from, obviously, is the gut. So your stomach, your intestines, there's this whole area around your abdomen called the splanchnic circulation.
That's a great word.
It's a word in need of some vowels.
Can I try and practice that splanchnic?
Splanchnic.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's it.
Okay. I've learned a new word today.
Series of consonants.
Okay.
It is relatively underperfused by blood when we exercise. The problem with that is that then our body's ability to take nutrients and fluids from the stomach, the intestine, into the circulation is compromised.
And so in other words, if you have a big meal before an exercise session, your meal will not digest at the rate that it would normally do because your blood is all moved into other essential parts of the body.
Not just digest, but also be absorbed. So the two processes. So now what's happening is you've got this food, fluid, sitting there. No place to go because it can't.
That damn splanchnic system.
And the consequence is that the nausea, the vomiting center is triggered by the gastrointestinal tract and we get sick and feel ill and we throw up. And so this is where we make mistakes sometimes by trying to overconsume fluid and we overconsume food or we consume our food or fluid too close to exercise. That's why the first thing I ask Liz is your diet not only the same in content but timing? You know, and for sure, I remember when I was with the South African Sevens team, you had to be very careful. You can't have that meal an hour before exercise because then it is sitting there. You have to give yourself an opportunity to absorb and so on. So, and then the nature of it. Proteins, dairy, fats are much more difficult than simple sugars when we are exercising to get into the circulation. So the content and the volume and the timing interact with one another to potentially trigger those gastrointestinal signals to the vomiting center. Make sense?
Right. Yeah.
Now, with duration, that obviously becomes progressively more and more important. A couple of reasons. One is you can't do 12 hours without eating or drinking something. So you have to exercise and fuel at the same time. 30 minutes, you don't need that. So now you've got the problem of trying to take in foods to a system that's not really ready for them and able to cope with them. If you get that slightly wrong, consequences are nausea, vomiting. The other thing that happens is the longer we go, the more plasma volume reduction we see because we're sweating and losing fluid. We're sending more and more blood to the skin and the circulation. So that problem gets worse over time. So the splanchnic circulation reduction is greater after many hours than after the first hour.
Okay.
Makes sense, right?
Right, yeah.
So all of those things are playing on this. So that's why ultra-endurance athletes have a bigger problem than shorter duration athletes. Then the other thing that happens is that our sympathetic nervous system is active when we exercise. We know this. That's fight or flight. It's necessary. Adrenaline and its cousin or family member, noradrenaline, are released. Those hormones directly stimulate the sensation of nausea. They know that because people who've had tumors, adrenal tumors, or in the nervous system, overproduce adrenaline. And one of the symptoms is nausea. And if they remove those tumors, that nausea goes away. So there's a direct effect of intensity. The harder I run or cycle, the more my noradrenaline and adrenaline levels go up, the more likely I am to become nauseous. So all of that's happening at the same time. So hot days, because we need more blood at the skin, because that's going to help keep us cool. More blood at the skin means less blood in the gastrointestinal tract. And so that same situation I spoke about earlier is exacerbated in the heat. So that explains to you why why nausea is more common in the heat than in the cool. So that was my other thought around Liz, by the way, is that maybe those morning races are cooler and the afternoon races are a little bit warmer, and that small difference is the trigger for nausea because of how it plays out in the skin versus the gastrointestinal tract.
Mm.
So where does this leave us? I think you have to, if you're someone who struggles with nausea, and this is most people at some point, you have to divide everything I've just said into two parts. One is the unmodifiable environment. You can't make it cooler. You can try and cool your skin down with water every once in a while and try and keep that circulatory adjustment from affecting you. That's fine, do that. But you're not going to make the air temperature cooler or less humid. You can't change the intensity. If you're running a 3-hour 30 marathon, that's what you have to do. You can't run 3:30 slower. It's by definition. Yeah. So there's certain things that are unmodifiable, and then there are certain things that are modifiable, and nutrition is the main modifiable factor. And so that is where we can do things and experiment and figure out what works and what doesn't work. Now, I wish that I could give Liz and everyone else listening a really simple list of 3 things to do and 3 things to avoid, but physiology unfortunately doesn't work like that. So you know, and I mean, just talking now about our weekly Friday and our Sunday rides, you know what works and what doesn't work for you, and you get on the bike knowing that you've messed it up before you even start.
Yep, that's true. Yeah, it is interesting because, I mean, we don't want to use ourselves as an example here, but sometimes it is interesting to draw the parallels, is that our Friday afternoon ride, there's a bit of an in-joke with the crowd that we ride with that I always get my nutrition wrong, because I get to a point in the day when I get very hungry and therefore I eat and potentially I overeat. So by the time we're riding at Hoppers 3, my stomach's still full. And I can understand where Elizabeth is with this, because you still have to eat throughout the day before you do that race in the afternoon, the early evening. And you know, if you've slept and maybe the next morning you wake up and have a bit of slice of peanut butter toast with some jam in it, that's your go-to early morning thing. That's what you've eaten in 8 hours.
Yeah.
Whereas potentially if she's running in the evening, she's had breakfast and dinner and lunch and maybe an afternoon snack. So the process of nutrition is totally different. And I guess she has to just experiment to find out what works.
Exactly. So the exercise or race meal in the morning comes off a fasted state, as you said, 8 to 10 hours of not having eaten. That will be seen and managed by the body quite differently from even the same meal after a 4-hour fast, because the meal before that was lunch, and then I had a little bit of a snack top up. Even if that top up's the same, it's part of a bigger picture. So you got to look at the whole picture, not just the last thing. So that's key lesson number one. There are studies that have looked at volume, and the rule of thumb is that if you feel full, you're much more likely to get nauseous. This is logical.
Yeah.
So if that's you and you start exercise feeling fullish, there's a perception of fullness, you've eaten too close to when you train. Or you've eaten proteins and fats, which create that feeling of fullness more than a carb does. You don't want to start hungry, because that's a sign of low blood sugar coming up and creeping up on you. But you don't want to start with any sensation of fullness.
Want something that's going to digest quickly in the build-up to race. Like you talked a little bit about your sevens rugby experience.
Yes.
When those 7 rugby players who are, you know, got half an hour or so between matches, what are they consuming in that time?
Luckily, like more than that, like 3 hours maybe, 3 to 3.5 hours.
Yeah.
So obviously you finish a game, you have to ice, take the strapping off, shower, change. That's a half an hour to 45 minutes. Then it's straight in to try and replenish the energy from the match as quickly as possible. Generally, at those events, the host organization puts on a buffet almost of food. It's not super rich foods. You're not going to go and eat seafood and so on. No. It's potatoes, pastas, muffins, fruit. That's basically what you drink, and fluids. Not too much. I mean, and we used to trust the players to know their own bodies through experience to know how much they could tolerate, because you can't eat to satisfy your hunger when you've only got an hour and a half till the next game, because then you're going to be carrying food. So you have to almost learn from your mistakes, probably, to not eat as much. The closer we got to the game, the more refined the carbs got, which I appreciate is not healthy. But at that stage, you're not worried about that. You're trying to avoid fibers. Again, dairy, not ideal, because that's going to sit and cause stomach upsets. So really, it was energy jellies, jelly babies, fruit, muffins would be the choice of food. And then once you get into the change room and the warm-up begins, we used to have a bowl of jelly babies in the middle, and the guys were picking from that. I remember going and doing shopping duty and just stocking up with every bag of Haribo and jelly that the pharmacy would have, because that's what they were consuming, because that's what you need in that moment. Volume is key, though, and like there are studies there where if people are forced to drink 1,000 mils an hour, so that's a liter per hour, which in all but the most difficult environmental conditions, that will be equal to or greater than your sweat rate, unless you're Matteo van der Poel riding in a hot day at the intensities that those guys are riding. So most people, 3.5-4 hour marathoners, coolish day, 1 liter an hour is estimated sweat loss. If you consume that much, stomach discomfort goes up twice as high as if you consumed less than 600. Stomach discomfort drives nausea. So the overconsumption of fluid is a big contributor to nausea. And again, sure, that's something that happens with temperature. We might drink too much, too quickly for our stomachs to absorb. Now you've got fluid sloshing about in your stomach, and that's coming up the moment you get nauseous. The content of that fluid is key. If you drink sugary drinks and they're too sugary, what happens is that fluid then moves into the stomach because it's attracted there by the sugar content, osmolality basically. That then causes you to throw up fluid. So you got to drink small doses of not too sweet fluid often, as opposed to a big chug of a 500 ml and then try again. So these are little things that every athlete must experiment with, practice with it. Do it at race intensity. You know, if your race pace is 4:30 a kilometer, don't practice at 5:30, because the intensity, as I was explained to you, is going to tip you over the edge and you're going to get nauseous with the same nutrition. So the answer to Liz is you have to play around in the afternoon when your problem exists with volume, with type, with timing, at the same intensity as you intend to race, and you will learn what your body can handle. I mean, I remember meeting a guy who would run ultra marathons. We're talking 32, 34 mile or 60 miles on nothing but milk. I couldn't have a teaspoon of milk and it would be coming up. So different people can tolerate different things. You have to play detective with the principles that we've discussed in mind. Type, volume, timing against intensity, and try and figure out where you can pull it off for yourself.
Yeah. So there we go. There we have it, Liz. Be experimental, I guess, in the way that you do this stuff in the afternoon, particularly if you're doing afternoon races, because it is a complex and there's no one size fits all, I think, for this kind of solution. I must say, I find that the slice of toast at about 2 hours before our afternoon rides, it digests in time. But anything more than that, I struggle to digest it. You know, if I have a decent lunch, and even if it's 2 hours before the ride, it's a struggle to get that digested in time for the ride. You want to be slightly hungry, but not ravenously hungry, I always think, before you take on a bout of exercise, so that you know your stomach is empty.
Right. You need your stomach empty, but your blood
energy
and liver
levels are still
your blood and liver full.
Yeah.
If you can think of them like that. So if you imagine the food moving from your hand into your mouth, into your stomach, into the intestine, and then it's going to the liver, the blood, the muscles, you've got to get it so that it's finished part one, but it's still there for part two of that journey, if that makes sense.
I suppose to some extent that's the journey of what we are as athletes, you know, when you're out there and experimenting with this kind of stuff. It's not fun to feel nauseous, but it is fun to understand how your body works, and the more that we experiment with the kind of things and the different foods, suddenly we just come on a my wife makes these wonderful tennis biscuit with fruit on top that she makes every couple of weeks, and I have that before I go and ride in the mornings now, and I find that's really worked for me because it just gives my blood sugar a bit of a kick in the morning instead of going out empty, and I've had some good rides as a result of that. And it's literally just one square of this little biscuit type thing, but you know, it seems to work for me, and I will probably continue doing that.
See, whereas I decline it when Mike's wife offers, because I've learned that I don't for some reason tolerate fruit. I don't know whether that's the fiber or something, but I know that if I have that, I'm going to eat it twice, which is never fun. So bananas, no go.
Really?
Whereas oranges I could have an orange, or even a little bit of apple and so on. So anyway, the point is we learn through mistakes. So you really, if you have to try and practice these things. And what Liz's question highlights is that when you figured it out for one situation, don't necessarily assume that that's going to work in another, because you might be the difference. And so it's one of the most interesting things. And one of the jobs of a scientist or a coach is to guide the process by which you learn, because you have to be systematic. You have to try and change one thing at a time. You've got to understand, like, so if you could figure it out on a cool day, and then race day is 10 degrees warm and it doesn't work, and you say, but well, that's because the temperature was different.
Sure.
And so if you're going to experiment, change one thing at a time, see what it does. If it works, stick until the next time it doesn't, and try and figure out what it was. Be systematic.
Yeah. Mm. That's a good bit of advice to end that answer off on. Right, our next question comes from Martin Roman, and I imagine that Martin is not English speaking, but he has sent his question in English, so we had to kind of translate it a bit. So we kind of read through the question, and I'll kind of paraphrase it to some extent. He says, I've always wanted to answer the ultimate question. And he talks a bit about the fact that how do we get in the future an answer to what is the decomposition in percentage with regards to body and mind? He then goes on to explain, let's say with a chip on your body, measuring the process, for instance, to know exactly when the shutdown of the body will come. Now, if you read that question in its entirety, I guess what Martin's getting to is that when is the body imminently going to collapse during exercise? Mm. And will we ever know that point? In other words, if we inserted a chip and it would say, warning, warning, you're about to shut down. Or is there something else at play that prevents the body from getting to that point in terms of the mind? And can we, I suppose my question is, can we override that mind to allow the body to go further?
And I would add another is that even if we know that the mind-body link is happening to regulate us, to protect us from ourselves during sport, will we ever be able to measure that link and understand when it's happening? In other words, can we put a trace, a chip, as Martin alludes to, in the brain in a way that it actually can identify where that failure point is going to happen? Whether it's brain or body, is it going to be measurable one day? So he talks about it as the ultimate question, and it actually is. I mean, for me, my PhD was on this subject, and it was the ultimate question, and it was an unanswerable ultimate question, which is part of the reason why I left this field of study. Because where I'd gotten to in 2006, now we're going back some years, obviously.
So just to simplify that, when you say the ultimate question is how far can you go? How far can you push your body?
I think the way Martin's asking it, that's part of it. I think the way that it's been asked here is, will we ever be able to quantify the contribution of that mind to the process, as opposed to measuring what's happening in the body only?
Okay.
What I found frustrating in the process of gathering data for my PhD is that we were using such blunt instruments to try and measure what was happening in an unbelievably precise brain system.
Give us an example of how you were doing one of those blunt instruments.
So we can be reductionist here, for instance. Talk about the simplest application of this is that when we get too hot, we stop. Mm-hmm. There is a short circuit, in effect, where a body temperature beyond 40 degrees Celsius causes us, in most, and this is almost all instances, to fail. We don't fail with death, luckily. We fail with fatigue. And so I never forget, like, reading the studies, they all came out of Scandinavia. They do this unbelievable stuff there. Like, I don't know how they even get ethical approval, but they would make athletes exercise in the heat until they got hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter. And by the time they hit 40, they reported in their papers that these cyclists or runners started to become dizzy. They started to become disoriented. They would forget their own names. They would lose balance on the treadmill, and they would stagger about. And you can go on YouTube, you look up some famous cases. Jim Peters, 1954 Olympic Games. Mm. Gabrielle Anderson, 1984 Los Angeles Olympics, took 5 minutes to do the last lap, and she looked like she'd been shot on half her body with a tranquilizer dart. She was almost paralyzed on one half of her body. That is a classic manifestation of an excessively hot system. Now, what the Scandinavians, the Danes, really deduced is that because you're seeing what looked like paralysis, motor failure, this heat had to have some central role in the brain. So the model that was developed at the time was that the hot brain fails to activate muscle in order to continue exercise. So it is basically a short circuit that says you're now too hot. You're hyperthermic, too high temperature, and we're going to cause you to fail. Now that's a simple manifestation. That's a fail safe. Yeah. That's a simple manifestation of this idea that there's something in the body that causes you to stop. And to some extent, you can measure that because we could measure. The Danes figured that that was happening at 40. Now, sometimes you can go beyond 40. We know that drugs, performance-enhancing drugs, override the body's normal sensations of fatigue and allow athletes to get hotter. There was this famous study by Philip Watson where they gave athletes a drug called bupropion, and with that drug in their system, they would get to 41 degrees because the signal to stop was delayed. And so, again, it implicates the brain because the central, this bupropion was a central nervous system. I think it was a noradrenaline reuptake inhibitor, so that's how it was working. So, fascinatingly, you can override it. Tom Simpson allegedly took amphetamines to the point that he was able to exercise himself into heat stroke.
Well, that's the question. So, if they were able to move somebody artificially into 41 degrees when the body was normally shutting down at 40, do we know then what the temperature, what is the maximum temperature? So, when Tom Simpson dies on the top of the mountain because he's fueled by a cocktail of mixtures,
yeah,
is it because his body potentially just reached its limit because it wasn't being sufficiently governed?
I don't know. It's never been measured in those circumstances. Yeah. I mean, the aforementioned Dale Ray, who's now a sleep expert, she and I co-wrote a paper together where we'd looked at heat strokes and we'd identified that most of the time, people who die from excessive heat during exercise have had something metabolically go wrong inside of them.
Because not necessarily the temperature, the high temperature or the highest temperature.
Of the day, no. So, I mean, there are some heat strokes documented when it's in the single digit Celsius temperatures. I mean, so that's a cold day. Mm. And they don't happen in the winners. They happen more often than not in the guys coming in the last quarter of the race. So they're not running fast enough to generate the heat. It's not hot enough to cause them to not lose the heat. So therefore, something else inside, we called it excessive endothermy. So excessive endo being inside, thermy heat production. So something was, I mean, I've said even on this podcast, I remember being in the medical tent at an ultramarathon here in Cape Town, and a guy came in, body temperature 41 degrees. They put him in a big bathtub filled with ice water. I mean, that's shiver material. 5 minutes there, you should be shivering. This guy got hotter. It was extraordinary. Uh-huh. He continued to get hotter sitting in a bath of ice water. And so something inside of him is just malfunctioning. He's producing so much heat sitting there that not even ice water can cool him
down. That's scary, isn't it?
And so something's gone wrong in the metabolism.
Did he survive?
I think he did, yes. Many times you don't. Mm. And so heat stroke can be fatal. It's a fatal complication of exercise. But my feeling is that there's probably some underlying pathology in all but very rare cases. So when Anderson crossed the finish line in that Los Angeles marathon, she probably felt worse than she ever had. But half an hour later, she's recovered. Jim Peters didn't finish the 1954 marathon in Vancouver. He recovered. Now, there are experts on this who say you never fully recover, and that may well be true. You might actually do long-term damage, but it's non-lethal because the body's failure to keep you going is the final line of protection. Makes sense. So anyway, so this is somewhat labored in answer to your question. The key thing is we could measure, and even in my PhD we did studies on this, we could measure body temperature. We could measure muscle activation, admittedly somewhat crudely, open to criticism, but we could do that. We can measure power output, which is a function of how well your muscles are activating and working. But we couldn't see inside the brain.
Yeah.
So you couldn't, you could ask me, and I'm sure you had back then, is what's actually happening in the brain to cause that? I don't know. Yeah. No one does, because the complexity and the chaos of exercise makes it impossible to see inside the brain. So when I read Martin's question, that it took me back to that issue. And what had happened was, Tim Noakes had proposed the idea of a central governor, which was a philosophical concept of an area of the brain that would function almost like a black box,
yeah,
and control these protective mechanisms. Because not just heat, it was blood sugar levels, it was sodium levels, it was oxygenation potentially of the muscle, the brain, the heart, who knew? But it was lots of different things. So dozens of different systems feeding information to the brain, it then had to make a decision. That was the central governor concept. But it was, like, ridiculed might seem too strong a word, but there were neuroscientists who were ridiculing that concept because you couldn't measure, and like, where is this black box, they used to say. They used to make jokes about like a little ghost in your brain that was doing all this. And it did a disservice to the model almost, because no one could understand and explain the mechanism by which this process happened. You could see it happening, but you couldn't fill in the blanks.
Makes so it was a philosophical theory rather than a
physiological one. And then I always thought
it was actually a real. There was a lot of evidence to suggest that this was absolutely true, and there was some physiological evidence that was true.
You can see it happening.
Yeah,
and you can see so the principle, the central
it's
governor
the stuff
model,
happening around that convinces you that there's something happening inside.
Exactly, it's like you can see that the sky is blue, and you know that it's nighttime because it's not blue anymore. But you can't explain why it is until you now. There's a mechanism that explains that. We couldn't find that, and so then I added to the model thinking because then I came up. I tried to move away from central governor specifically because people were criticizing that ghost black box thinking. And I proposed instead like anticipatory regulation based on perception of effort. So, you know, you're getting this feedback for the oxygen, the energy supply, the body temperature, the environmental temperature. Emotional inputs are contributing to how you feel during exercise. So when you're winning, you don't stop. When you're beaten, you slow down. That's got nothing to do with physiology. When you are highly motivated by an incentive, you keep going. When you don't have that incentive, the same effort, the same perception of effort is too hard. Mm. And so the context is always changing. And so at the conscious level and at the subconscious or the unconscious level, all these different things are mixed up in the brain. There must be elements of memory. How do you know to start slower on a hot day?
Yeah.
That's because you remembered the last time you went too hard and you blew.
Yeah.
How do you know to slow down when you are glycogen deplete? In other words, if you start exercise with low glycogen levels, there are studies that have shown that from the first few moments, athletes go slower. They don't know that consciously. We don't have, we're not cars with a fuel gauge.
Yeah.
A little light comes on and says, please fill up. We don't have that, but somehow we know it. And so on an unconscious level, we're regulating our performance based on physiology. If you teleported me to altitude without telling me, and I'm at 3,500, 4,000 meters, I will know within 2 minutes of starting that something's not right. There's nothing yet measurably wrong in my body. I'm not oxygen deprived.
So what you're saying is if somebody kidnapped you, wrapped you in a blindfold and took you to the top of a place where you didn't know was high altitude, you'd know straight away when you were running just from a physiological effort level.
I'd be running 5 minutes a K. This is the normal pace, but this just feels different.
Yeah.
It's harder to breathe. Okay, and then I'll deduce. So then suddenly that subconscious signal, probably carried by slight desaturation in the brain, the PO2, maybe the PCO2, whatever it is, your pH could be changed in your initial response to altitude. That's saying to your brain, this is hard. Harder than usual, and suddenly becomes too hard because you're contextualizing that perception of effort against expectations and so on. And so studies have been done where if you change expectations, you change perception of effort, you change performance. So,
is it too simplistic to say, based on physiological principles, that the body inherently will protect itself, and therefore all the systems are designed to ensure survivability?
Yes, that's exactly
so
what
it is.
So
that's a physiological principle.
That's exactly what it is. Yeah. Because even the hardest effort in the world with the Olympic medal on the line and a life's work, someone is going to lose that race. There's a sprint for the line. Someone is going to lose. And then you say, well, he could have gone quicker, right? But no, because the physiology just would not allow that, no matter how motivated you are. Now, think back.
The physiology or the entire makeup of that person?
So
that's where it becomes philosophical.
This is the question I think Martin is asking. Is it the physiology or is it the whole thing, including the mind? Now, as a physiologist, I'm skewed to say that the mind is physiology.
Yeah.
If we could measure this, somewhere in the brain, at that moment of fatigue, there'll be neurotransmitter changes that are responsible for what we measure as an outcome. We just haven't measured that. There'll be EEG changes. Functional mRNAs will one day reveal where in the brain different things are happening to cause higher perception of effort, slowing in pace, stopping completely.
Yes.
And the big challenge was like we had this model. Tim had a model. I then try to develop and advance
Tim
that
Noakes,
model. Yeah, Tim Noakes, yeah. Sorry, the central governor. I try to develop and advance that. There are now other people who've thrown their sort of hats in the ring and subtly different models and so on. But they're all, it's wrong to say they're philosophy, because you can measure the outcome of that model. The best predictor made by central governor and my anticipated regulation is that there's an end spurt at the end of exercise.
Yes.
Now, that why is that so significant? That's significant because it shows you that we always exercise with some reserve capacity.
Yeah.
And no matter how bad you are feeling, you will speed up at the finish line. Sometimes not much. Sometimes you won't, because there's no incentive to speed up. But an athlete will be dropped from the front of the race with 2 kilometers to go in a 10K, that athlete will still speed up at the finish. So then you say, well, why did he drop? Because he had reserve.
He had reserve, yeah.
He had the capacity to go faster. So why slow down at 8? That's where it gets really interesting. So
yeah, that becomes less about physiology then, if you're discounting that the mental side is not physiology.
Yes.
I define physiology as the body's mechanisms.
Correct. So you've got a...
I've got a journalistic simple view.
Yeah, no, but this is a key thing. Is physiology neck down? Not really, because there's still brain physiology. So what's mental? Where does mental start and physiology end, right? This is why it's such a great question.
It's a great question.
It is the ultimate question. It's known, for instance, that like self-talk improves performance.
Yeah, and that is true.
Studies have been done where they'll take a group of guys, admittedly not elite athletes. I suspect elite athletes are immune, quote unquote, to these kind of interventions because they're already doing the things that are necessary. Mm. If you don't have self-talk capacity, as you don't become an elite athlete.
Yeah.
So what is self-talk?
Okay.
Example, they take a couple groups and they let them do exercise trials to fatigue at like 80% of max. They see how long they go. Then they take one of those groups and they give them self-talk lessons. Now, that involved in this particular study, I think they gave them 12 like mantras they could say to themselves, and they had to choose the 5 that resonated with them. So for instance, you're looking good, you're feeling strong, you've got this, keep going, you're the man, whatever it is like that makes you,
yeah,
you know, and we all have it, right? Like if you're on your bike or on a run and you're starting to hurt, what do you say to yourself? That's self-talk.
Well, to give an example, we know a personal trainer whose natural life's work is to encourage people to train harder, and he's one of the guys we ride with. And there's no doubt that when Richard is behind me going, looking good, you're going strong, well done, there's no doubt that you ride better.
Yes.
And that's just somebody else from behind, right, going, and it doesn't necessarily, I can feel terrible 5 minutes before, but just those words of encouragement from somebody in my group will change my perception of my effort.
Right. Now, yeah. Can you...
That's unquantifiable though, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I mean, so there are studies like in Japan, they do this study where they make guys come in and they're in a lab and they're doing a maximum knee extension. So this is like when you go to the gym and you're doing leg extensions on the weight machine. And these guys are pushing out and they've got to go 2 minutes as hard as possible. And sure enough, as they get fatigue, and this is in the muscle, part of it anyway, the force production drops over time. It's coming down, 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 down. It's descending over time. And then all of a sudden, they give them some cheering. They got a little crowd behind them and they cheer. Like 30 seconds to go, the force goes back up. So whatever decline was happening in the presence of the capacity to find more.
Yeah.
And then right at the end, at the moment of like absolute fatigue in this study, they fired a gun off. Now that force goes right up, because that's the evolutionary equivalent of me being really tired from a day of hunting and then coming across a lion. And I'm like, it doesn't matter how tired I am, I'm going to find the energy to climb a tree, because it's a survival thing.
Yeah,
so
sure.
The end spurt was a survival mechanism, and it's the prediction made by a central governor or an anticipatory regulatory model. So it's quite fascinating in that regard. And just to show you how durable it is, there have been, I forget the exact number, 20-odd world records since the turn of the century, last century, since timekeeping began. 20 mid-20s for 5,000 and 10,000. Every single one of those has a fastest kilometer either at the end or the 9th kilometer.
Sure.
Without exception. And so what happens is they start fast, they slow down, they stay stable in the middle of a part of the race, and then either the 5th or the 10th kilometer is invariably faster.
Sure.
With, I think there's one exception where the 9th K was faster than the 10th, the fastest of the race.
Mm-hmm.
So even at the very limits of human performance, going faster than any human being in history has ever gone, we have the capacity to go a little bit harder. Now, coming back to self-talk.
It's amazing, isn't it?
So Richard is behind you shouting, go, 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 you're looking good. can you do that job for yourself? Yes, you can. Because imagine your self-talk the moment things got hard is you absolutely suck. You're so weak. Your legs are jelly. You're made of foam. You're actually just custard, man. Like, you should actually stop.
Yeah,
you're gonna stop. Absolutely. So what happened in the study, of course, is that when they trained these people, made them aware of positive self-talk, they come back a couple of weeks later and they go like 2 minutes longer, 20% improvement in performance. So I think elite athletes are already doing that. They are able to avoid the temptation to get down on themselves when things get hard. They actually probably embrace it. I mean, Martin spoke about elite athletes being masochists. They probably enjoy the pain and the suffering. You know, let's have more of it. So again, that's not physiology. It's self-talk. It's encouragement from other people, whether it's a crowd or a guy behind you on the bike. And so there are all these little places that we can unlock a little bit of performance. And what it ultimately then leads to is this eternal question of, is performance limited by the mind or the matter? And that's kind of like the ultimate question.
Yeah.
And it's both. Because
is it safe to say then, without people having to sign an indemnity form and suing us if something happens, that if you want somebody that exercises or wants to perform well, it's unlikely, and obviously there are exceptions, people with heart problems are the exception, but you can probably go as hard as you can relatively safely because your body is designed to stop you from getting into serious trouble unless you are suffering from some sort of heart defect or whatever.
Because it's going to be so painful at that point that you start to encroach upon your capacity.
Mm.
You know, the upper limits, rather, of your capacity, that it'll be so painful that you are going to probably stop. And I always somewhat jokingly say, like, nobody has ever committed suicide by holding their breath.
Yeah.
Because the physiology kind of does win eventually. But there can be little glitches in that system. So you have heard of Jim Peters got close. Salazar was a duel in the Sun 1980-something in Boston, I think it was. Might not have been Boston. I'm probably historically messing this up. All I can vouch for is I got the name right. Salazar ran himself to the point of basically needing a priest, was the story. You heard that one before.
Almost happened in the Comrades with him in 1994 as well.
Some people do have that capacity, and it would be fascinating to know, do they have an abnormally functioning system that doesn't alert them, you know? I don't think that invalidates the concept of a governor or an anticipatory regulatory system. In fact, if anything, it proves it, because there's a pathology, you know? I remember having a debate, by the way, on this in Amsterdam back in 2014, and it was mind over matter. And I was representing the matter side of the debate, and someone else was mind. And he made the point that when we see failures of physiology, like athletes collapsing, that invalidates that there's this control system. Well, no, I mean, no more than people get diabetes. That doesn't mean insulin and the pancreas don't do their job. It's just that we can sometimes abuse our physiology, or there's a underlying pathology that makes us vulnerable to failures of what normally works in most cases. And so in answer to your question, unless there is something there, you will be protected by your own brain / body.
Yeah.
And in answer to Martin's question, I think eventually it'll be possible to look inside the I'm not going to say black box, because actually it's the whole brain.
The whole brain, it's the whole being.
I mean, the whole being. That's exactly what it is. So how you ever tease, and that's the problem with models, is that they try and compartmentalize, and that forces the simplicity that just doesn't work. But it's that whole being. One day I think we'll have a better picture of how that whole being is integrated. But right now, and back in 2006, we didn't. And it got frustrating enough that I left it behind, because until someone can explain what we observe with what's actually happening, that whole thing is going to be incomplete. And so I don't know whether this is all philosophical for our listeners, other than the fact that reminding you that you always have a reserve capacity. Emotion is as important to performance as physiology, and you can try and unlock that and remind yourself of that end spurt capacity all the time.
I'll be interested to see in the next couple of decades potentially, that maybe the last frontier of sporting excellence is how far you can manipulate the mind to make you better. And I guess if there's any young budding sports scientists who are listening to our podcast, I'm sure they're all sitting there thinking, if I could be that guy that could measure the brain's or the mind's effect on performance, I'd be the ultimate sports scientist, wouldn't I?
Yeah, that's massive.
I bet there's some youngster thinking about a way to do that.
Or cheat. I mean, because if the brain is stopping us 3% before we're going to die, and the margin of victory in a race is 2%, then this is the difference. And someone's looking for it. We know this because it's already, like, we've spoken about doping. Doping is an attempt to hijack. They might not have known it at the time, but this is what they were doing, was to hijack or sidestep the normal regulation of physiology. There are other studies. I mentioned the bupropion one. There's other unbelievable ones where they give guys fentanyl, which listeners may know is a super dangerous prescription drug. Painkiller. Prince and Michael Jackson, I believe, both their deaths were caused by fentanyl overdoses.
Oh, okay.
And they give it to guys when they exercise, because what fentanyl does is it blocks pain signals. So it's also acting in the nervous system, different place to the other drug. But when we don't have pain signals, we just go off like crazy. You should see the amazing study. They make them do these 5K time trials. And with fentanyl,
how did they get that through
have,
this
I have
ethical,
no idea.
It's is this the Swedes again?
No, this is a guy called Marcus Amman, who was doing the study out of the US. He did a whole series of them with hyperoxia, hypoxia, fentanyl. Unbelievable research. Really, really good. And they go off like a house on fire. Like, because there's no signal saying slow down. And they just go off like crazy. And then by halfway, the house is burned to the ground and they have to almost stop and crawl to the finish line, because the physiology pays eventually, because there is such a thing as peripheral failure. You know, if you go off too hard, you do compromise your muscles. So this idea that it's all in the brain or all in the muscle is clearly false.
Yeah,
it's regulated brain and body. And you can sidestep that. Last one, because I know we're going on in time. There are studies that are now looking at how you can stimulate areas of the brain through the skull using magnets. Transcranial.
Yes, I've heard about this. Yeah.
Transcranial magnetic stimulation. Yeah. And I remember back in 2004, we had a guy, Zig St. Clair Gibson, also one of the in fact, a lot of the stuff I ended up doing on the anticipatory regulation was born off his work. He wrote a paper once talking about ghosts and zombies and self-talk long before other scientists made it fashionable. He was actually the guy who did this. And he went to Washington for some sabbatical work and said that he'd gone and been a volunteer in these studies, and he lost his memory for like a week. So the problem was that you couldn't stimulate specific areas of the brain without stimulating other areas around it. And I'm sure this was 20 years ago.
Well, I mean, there are people who go through electroshock therapy for depression and that sort of thing. So they are able to change the manner of the brain, aren't they?
So this is
a scary place we're going with this.
So this is a frontier that's being explored. Absolutely. And there was talk that Salazar, the aforementioned, was exploring this in his athletes. We've actually got a book and a nice lead to explore, and that's a question to ask.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the point is, once you know that there's a regulatory system, a pilot, if you wish, your next question is, how can you corrupt the pilot? And so that's maybe where this leads. But for now, Martin, unfortunately, no. But hopefully you've got some interesting discussion out of your great question.
Yeah, great. Thanks very much, Martin. Right, so our last two questions, and they're both similar in nature. So we'll kind of tackle them in a simple way. The first one was from Matthew Wolstenholm, who says, love the past podcast. Please keep up the good, great work. Speaking of Usain Bolt, one hypothetical question I've always wondered, how good would he have been at other athletic events or sports? I know he tried football, but the intricacies of sport always meant he was unlikely to compete at a high level. Would he have been a good cyclist, for instance? And then Chris Davey, who asks a question very similar to this, saying, a lot of podcasts you talk about for human physical optimization for some form in professional athletes for their particular sport. Basketball players are always typically tall, runners are lean, etc., etc. Squash is an unusual sport in that there are lots of body types among the world-class players that adapt afterwards. So I think what he's asking at the end of the day here is that, you know, how many sports can you cross over, and how many great athletic people can cross over to sports? And I know before this podcast, we talked specifically about in the States, there seems to be a huge crossover between athletes who are NFL footballers and basketball players, which is remarkable. And then there was the story, which I looked up on the interwebs, which we talked briefly about, Jim Thorpe, who in 1912, he won Olympic gold in both the pentathlon and decathlon, both which showed ridiculous versatility of its own. He played professional football for 13 years, Major League Baseball for 7 years, and professional basketball for at least 2 years. So he was the ultimate multi-sport athlete. But I guess that the question is, let's take Usain Bolt as an example.
Yeah.
If he hadn't chosen sprinting, would he be in good world class in any other sport?
This is pub and pizza conversation, because this is the kind of stuff that you can argue about and never find resolution, because it's all speculative. So it's a fun, both of them are fun questions, because they introduce us to a whole world of sports science that is quite imprecise. You know, like when we talk about nausea and vomiting, we can go into Latin terms in the brain. This stuff, it's concepts, models, theories. It's cool, but it's maybe a little bit more evasive. So let's have a couple of principles. One is that athleticism is universal. I mean, athletes are athletes, but it's not necessarily specific enough to transfer perfectly from one discipline to the next. This should be obvious. So if we have a Venn diagram of a great athlete like Usain Bolt in track and field and great athletes in football, they don't overlap, which is just as well, because that would be boring. So the attributes that make Usain Bolt the world record holder in the 1-2 and the relay would translate to some degree into other sports. So in football, which he tried, there is a requirement for speed. So he was never lacking there. But there was also a requirement for half a dozen other things, where he may not have had the same abilities as a Drogba, Ronaldo, or Messi. And so the moment the sport gets a little bit more complex, there are more ways to win, but there are also more ways to fail. And so therefore it doesn't translate. Now, so that should be obvious, yeah?
Yeah.
I would think.
Yeah.
The second principle is that certain attributes exclude us from certain sports. Usain Bolt was never going to be a gymnast. He just was, it wasn't going to happen.
No.
In the same way that Lionel Messi was never going to be a weightlifter. Well, who knows? Maybe it could have been there were weight categories for weightlifting that might have actually found his way. And there was a Turkish weightlifter called Naim Süleymanoğlu, which was the greatest name in sport other than Jamaluddin Abdüjabbarov.
Yes.
And he was a tiny little guy. You look up Süleymanoğlu if you can figure out. Hopefully Google will correct it. And he was a tiny little guy, like one of the great Olympic lifters. Who knows? Maybe I said that. He maybe failed a drugs test. Probably he's a weightlifter. So there are certain body types that are excluded, like tiny short folk aren't basketballers, whereas if you are a 6'8" foot athlete in America, there's a very high probability, relatively, that you will become a basketballer. David Epstein, who we've spoken to, had a great stat in his first book called Sports Genes, saying that if you are taller than 7 foot in the U.S., there's a 1 in 6 chance that you'll be in the NBA. So every sixth 7 footer plays professional basketball in the U.S.
So the measure of a good basketball player, therefore, is height, not very little else.
Well, height
is an amazing stat, really.
But you see, so this is what gets nuanced, because it's not that the measure of a good basketball player is height, because the best basketball player is not the tallest one. Right.
Yeah.
So it's not, because it's not a perfect predictor. It's a contributing factor. So height. So now what you could do is you could say that height translates between different sports. Footballers like American footballers like Jim Thorpe and basketballers both tend to be taller than average. Basketball in particular. I think the average height in the NBA is, I saw these stats recently, I've now forgotten, it's a 23 odd centimeters higher than the average population of the US. So This should be obvious to anyone.
Yeah.
If you want to find a tall person, look in the NBA. It's obvious.
Yeah.
Now, that height is also advantageous in half a dozen other sports. And so, therefore, if you have it, provided you have a minimum amount of certain other athletic attributes, you will be successful in those sports too. And that's why you get so many crossovers between basketball and American football in the U.S. college system. There are similarly crossovers between track and field and football. Why? Because speed is a requirement. If you go to the NFL draft day, which you alluded to earlier, they are assessing 40-meter sprint time because they believe, and you could question this, it is a reasonable predictor of your potential in the NFL. Now, being fast alone is not enough. You still have to have certain degree of game intelligence. You have to have hand-eye coordination. You have to be able to be evasive and therefore be agile, and a degree of strength. So it's not a pure speed competition like a 100 is, but it should not come as a surprise that some of the fastest ever college track sprinters have also been great NFL players. I was looking up the other day, there's a young guy called Trindon Holliday in the early 2000s, came second in 2007 at the US track and field trials in the 100, beaten only by Tyson Gay. Wow. He turned down a chance to run at the World Champs because it was going to clash with his NFL obligations, because he was also a kick returner, wide receiver for, I think at that stage it was Denver, but he made a good career in the NFL.
I was going to say, he made more money in NFL than he would have made in a track and field anyway.
Yeah, unless he was Bolt.
Yeah, well.
Yes. Yeah, the average NFL is probably the exceptional track athlete. But yeah. Point being that he had an attribute that was transferable enough that he could move from one sport to the next. So this introduces us to this concept of talent transfer. And this is the idea that, you remember earlier I used the analogy of, we've created a sports system where we basically got people waiting for a bus, and then as that bus comes along, some people get on, others don't, and the bus is gone. One chance. Talent transfer is saying that you don't have to get on this bus, because in a few minutes from now, there's going to be a taxi. So it's a different thing, but you can get on that too. And the principle is that if you've got a degree of athleticism, you can turn your talent in one sport into success in another. Now, the most famous example of this, which is actually published, there's a study out on this, we'll give it to you in the show notes, is that the Australians figured that they could find world-class skeleton athletes. You familiar with skeleton?
It's basically a more extreme version of luge.
Yeah, it's basically you and your kitchen tray and 30 degrees downhill on ice.
Great description.
So we're not Winter Olympic fans down here in South Africa. We lack ice and snow. No. But like every 4 years, it's a thing, and you watch this. And yeah, so
I would have been very good at luge if I just had the opportunity.
Well, luge, skeleton or luge. So what's the difference? The difference is back on your back or on your stomach, and it's head versus feet first, right?
Yeah.
So luge is feet first on your back. Skeleton is head first on your stomach. Now, in skeleton, you run with your sled. I think it's... please don't write and tell me I'm using the wrong words.
I'll look it up.
But what the Aussies had predicted, had worked out, is that almost half the performance variation in a skeleton event is determined by your speed over the first 30 meters before you start actually sliding. So they said, if we can find fast people, we have a chance in this event. That makes sense?
Yeah.
Now, that's not dissimilar to bobsled, because in bobsled, the performance is determined in large part, or in significant part, let me say, not large, because it might not be half, by the speed with which you start off. And that is the reason why bobsledding has become a talent transfer vehicle for track and field athletes. Yep. Lauren Williams was a world medalist in the 100. She is now a medalist in bobsled. In fact, she's an Olympic medalist in both those disciplines. Lolo Jones, who famously almost and should have maybe won the 100-meter hurdles in Beijing 2008, is a world championship competing bobsledder for the USA. There are other athletes who have turned their track sprint abilities into bobsled performance. Cool Runnings.
I was going to say the Cool Runnings movie probably precipitated a lot of those people.
Yeah, because in that movie, John Candy recognized the same thing that the Australians recognized, is that if we can find speed, we might be able to find, in his case, bobsled performance. And remember, there's a scene in that movie where he says to the coach, a former colleague, whatever it is, from somewhere, about how he's found these guys, and they are lightning. And the guy says to him, yeah, but can lightning run on ice?
Yeah.
So that's the specificity coming. It's not enough to just be fast. Plus, of course, you need a pilot in the sled. Yeah. It's not just a question of let gravity work for you. So the point I'm trying to make is that if you understand the components that contribute to a sport, you can almost reverse engineer in order to find those elements. And that's what the Aussies did. So they'd identified skeleton as a potentially soft medal. And they then said, right, if we want to produce skeleton athletes, we need speed. And they invited athletes from all around Australia to come along for a testing day, where they looked at surf lifesavers, they looked at sprinters, they looked at athletes from sports where speed is also a prerequisite. They got 26 athletes that they recruited based on a 30-meter sprint time. That was it. Nothing else. How fast can you run 30 meters? That is what we will pick you based upon. They took those 26, then they did slightly more detailed testing, power, jump, intelligence, maybe a little bit of psychological screening. They trimmed the 26 down to 10. Those 10 were eventually put into an intensive skeleton-specific camp, so now you're learning actually the sport. And eventually they got athletes to the Olympic Games. And so they took people who'd never seen skeleton, never even tried it, maybe never even seen ice. And within, I think the word was 14 months, they managed to get Olympic athletes out of them, purely by understanding how one attribute, speed, transferred from one sport to the next.
Yeah, so there is, I mean, for the record, we did look this up and to look at the success of the Jamaican team, which obviously the Cool Runnings movie was based on a true story. And the latest news was that the women's bobsled team qualified for the last Winter Olympics, but they never got further than just qualifying. I think they finished 19th overall. So, And I guess that's a good result from a nation that doesn't have ice. But for the men's team, obviously they didn't qualify. So as you say, there was potential for do well, but there's so much involved in elite sport, right up to the high level heritage, passion for that sport. You know, learned experience, you know.
IP or intellectual capital, whatever you want to call it, equity that's accumulated over generations can't be replaced. I mean, if it could be, China would be a football or soccer superpower. Because they're certainly trying. There's enough money in the sport and there's certainly a population, but they can't quite get there because of... And some, it's actually not that dissimilar to Japan in rugby. If you transposed what Japan is doing in rugby to other countries, you might have great success because of body type differences.
Yeah.
You just need a certain body type and you need a certain culture and you need, obviously, facilities. There's not many bobsled tracks in Jamaica. So access, opportunity... interact with talent to determine whether you can succeed. But the principle is that there are certain elements of physiology that translate very well. So speed skating and cycling does really well. Track, in fact, if you look up Olympic athletes who've medaled in both summer and winter games, you will find track cyclists who've won winter Olympic medals in speed skating.
Yes, that's true.
Because the one is effectively a form of training for the other.
Yes.
It's a cardiovascular activity driven by muscular power in the legs. So, logically, the transfer between them is quite high.
And a lot of very good trail runners are often good Nordic skiers.
Yes.
For similar reasons.
Exactly. Yeah. So, cross-country skiing interacts with certain other things because if you asked a physiologist to look at data and identify who on this sheet of paper has the capacity, he'd say, well, give me their VO2 max, their economy of movement, and some measure of lactate threshold. Now, those are the same three inputs that determine marathon running performance. That doesn't necessarily mean that a cross-country skier will be a good marathon runner or vice versa because they lack the body type. Marathon runners are exceptionally skinny, not much muscle mass. That might be different. They lack the tendon neuromuscular system because running involves eccentric contractions where you load the tendon and the muscle and they lengthen and you've got to have a degree of springiness that might not be required in a cyclist or a skier.
Yeah.
And that's why they don't transfer perfectly, which is great, again. Otherwise, it'd be boring.
You'd have the same one crowd dominating everything.
Exactly. So the Kenyans have got these super long tendons, short muscles, great efficiency at running. That doesn't translate to cycling as well, which is why the fact that they've got VO2 max and lungs and hearts doesn't mean they're going to be great cyclists because they lack other elements. But so anyway, the point I'm trying to make in answer to Matt's question and also to Chris's is that, of course, athleticism transfers if you understand which attributes make an athlete in sport X and then find another sport Y where the same or similar attributes matter also. And then sports teams employ scientists and people who are going to monitor things like bench press, like agility, like VO2 max, for instance, because they understand that having high or large or exceptional performance in those tests to some degree predicts sports performance.
Mm.
And because those tests overlap, sports performance must also. So that's how that plays out. And then to segue into Chris Davies' question, The body type is one element of what determines success. And as I said earlier, your body type is going to exclude you from certain things. That's key. You look at elite marathon runners, they are an unbelievably homogenous or similar group. They are ectomorphs to the max. They are super skinny. They've got distal elongation, you know, long skinny arms and legs, long tendons, short muscles. That's a distance runner. Yeah. If you don't have those attributes, you do not become a world-class marathoner. It's impossible. You're starting off 20% behind them.
But you can be a world-class Tour de France rider and have many different body shapes and sizes, even within the particular skill sets.
Yeah.
So you sometimes get tall climbers and short sprinters.
Yeah, so that's cycling's so that's really interesting.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
You look at Van der Poel, who at the weekend, that we're recording this just after Strade Bianche. I mean, he's tall.
Yeah.
And Egan Bernal, who was, and Alaphilippe also, I mean, put them in a lineup next to him and say, spot the cyclist. You probably wouldn't land on Van der Poel first.
Yeah, for sure.
But you can succeed in that sport despite differences in, and I suppose running, you know, you get Paul Turgot was a super tall guy.
Yeah.
Sammy Wanjiru was a super short one. So you will get variation, of course, but If you had to pick based on nothing more than measurements, you know what you'd pick for each of those sports. And then exceptions almost prove the rule rather than disprove it.
No, exactly.
So it really is a fascinating area. And then what makes it particularly interesting is that when the game changes, the ideal body shape changes. So tennis players now have to be tall because the game is so much built around power that purely being fast and having good reflexes is no longer enough. You have to be fast with good reflexes and long arms and reach, because those 3-4 centimeters extra are so decisive that you almost exclude it if you didn't have it. So, and different surfaces, right? So like height is beneficial for the serve when you played a bit of tennis. You know, if you can serve 10 kilometers an hour faster with the same accuracy, that's a significant advantage on serve.
Yeah. On grass and
particularly,
maybe not necessarily clay though.
Neutralized on other.
Yeah.
So it gets really interesting when you look at it that way. I mean, you know, the Russian woman, I was watching tennis at the weekend and I was watching it with someone who said, it's just like you can't even keep up with how many Russian names there are in the sport.
Oh, that's true.
That's been the case for 20 years. Mm. They look for height in their talent systems. Doesn't matter if you've got two athletes with equal tennis ability, they'll pick the taller one.
Yeah.
Because they understand that that's a significant contributor. Basketball, obviously height. What's interesting is that in the last decade or so, basketball players have started to get slightly shorter. The average height of players who are drafted in the NBA draft has decreased over the last 5 or 6 years because the way the game is played has changed a little bit. It's now more about three-point shooting, the Steph Curry Golden State model. I don't want to go, I'm walking on thin ice a little bit here. But there's certainly data that supports that.
Yeah.
Rugby, I just had a paper published about a month ago looking at the evolution of mass in elite rugby players. And sure enough, when rugby went professional, players got big quickly. I mean, we're talking massive growth. I mean, from between 1995 and 2007, huge, huge changes. Since 2007.
And somebody said to you the other day that the Springbok winning team of the 1995 World Cup, that the average size of players of a first team rugby team is about the same as that now.
Yeah, some first team.
That's dramatic.
Some 18-year-old boys are now the same as the average height of the adults in the 95 World Cup. And the England, I remember the stat came out at the time, the England side that won the under-20 World Cup 5 or 6 years ago was as heavy as their men's side. So and this is... I mean, this is a whole other conversation, but we've certainly driven the development of talent younger and younger, and that's one of the consequences, is academies are now producing physical athletes at the caliber of a professional even a few years before.
Mm.
But what's interesting about rugby is that since 2011, that height has that mass increase has stopped, and the mass of those players has now plateaued. And for the first time ever in 2019 World Cup, players got smaller, not by much, 1 or 2 kilograms. But part of that is also evolution of the sport. The game is now so much faster. The priority is on keeping the ball in play for much longer. That's been aided by law change, but then driven by tactical approaches of coaches. And so you can no longer get away with being 108 kilograms. You have to be 106. And so in certain positions, the players have gotten slightly smaller in order to be mobile and faster and more agile. So there's this constant dance almost between who's successful and how the game evolves. And it changes it very subtly. And it really is fascinating because the 1 or 2 centimeters. Like, so in basketball, again, David Epstein wrote the book on Sports Gene talking about this. You can succeed in basketball if you're shorter than average, but you'll tend to have longer arms relative to your height than average. So the shorter players tend to be disproportionately long. Mm. The taller players tend to be in proportion. The end result is that all of them are exceptional at playing the game above the ground. Whether they get there by virtue of their height or their long arms doesn't really matter. And if this effect was trivial, then players who are 170 would succeed in basketball quite often, and they don't. It's exceptionally rare. And so it's such a powerful effect that it actually blocks off your opportunities. I always use the term, your height, your body size, your body type, whether it's arm length, skinny legs, degree of ectomorphy, that's kind of your ticket in to the room. Mm-hmm. Once you're in, other stuff matters. But if you don't have that ticket, you are never getting in the first place. So super fascinating question. And I mean,
and there's always outliers in every single sport that defy what those people look like. And I guess also exactly. It depends, like, in your timing. You know, if you think about a few years ago, if you were a less than heavy rugby player, you might not have got through the initial phases of your rugby career because you were too small. Now you might have a chance with the same physiology. So I suppose timing in different sports, and sports, as you've just suggested, they evolve and change, and therefore the players that are given opportunity also evolve and change.
Yeah. And the other great implication of this is that if you specialize too young, then you put all your chips, let me mix my metaphors here, I was going to say put all your chips in one basket. You put all your eggs in one basket. And the consequence is that when you then go through adolescence and your body type changes in a direction that you may not have anticipated, you end up with the wrong body type for your sport. And so early selection and early specialization become progressively less and less efficient the younger you go, because you have to let the chips fall where they may in order to make that choice. And so the key lesson for parents and coaches who are still listening to this is don't commit until you absolutely have to. If you can keep your kids viable, in quotes unquote viable, in as many sports as possible for as long as possible, you have a much better chance of matching them to the sport they're most likely to succeed in. Now, there's not one match per person per sport. Hopefully we've already addressed that athleticism will to some degree transfer, such that as long as you're exposed and you're able to sample, learn the skills, the rules, hand-eye coordination. You know, some people just don't have that. They're runners and cyclists. They cannot catch, throw, and kick. So you want to try and get your children and the athletes who you're looking after to be as exposed as possible to as many different things for as long as possible, and then match them as late as you can. That's the key. And then never close the door. You know, that turnstile must never be one way only. You always want it to be possible to come back in. That's talent transfer, and even within the same sport. Yeah. So there's so many applications of this that are really fascinating. So hopefully, again, there's no answer to Matt or Chris's question, but we've hopefully given you some food for thought for the next time over beers you get into an argument about this.
You'll be able to have beers with some level of authenticity and knowledge.
Exactly.
So thank you very much to all of our question askers across our Patreon supporters. So we've done two different question and answer sessions over the last month or two. So thank you very much. And we've answered pretty much all the questions that you have asked. And we assure you that we will do it again later on in the year, because the first one did particularly well in terms of your interaction. Don't forget, you can interact with us on our Twitter feed, which is SportsSciPod, SportsSciPod. And of course, Professor Ross Tucker and myself, Mike Finch, also on Twitter, if you want to address us directly. But the SportsSciPod is the best way to interact. And give us your thoughts. Let us know what you think. If you disagree with us, you're very welcome to disagree, and let us know what your alternative thoughts are. But from us for now, it's goodbye.
Thank you for listening to the Science of Sport podcast. Follow us on Twitter at SportsSciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport podcast.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right, because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with five different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1, only from Rust-Oleum.